The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Football Weekly. Today, Tyne-Wear Derby. Three straight now for Sunderland, but sadly two goals short of me using a Hawaii 5-0 headline. Elsewhere, Wenger's Shellstrom Maelstrom after signing a player more prone to injury than Chico Flores in a West Ham game, but still back to winning ways thanks to his ox in the box. There's Toure as Poole commit harakiri, and oh yes, Man United lose in epic battle at the Britannia. Abroad, Atletico Madrid go top of the Liga. Juve destroy Inter. There's some cracking posts from you, listener, and more in today's Football Weekly. Yes, hello, everybody. Extraordinary weekend in football. And here to tell us all about it, Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
Hi, Barry. Jacob Steinberg.
Hello.
And James Horncastle.
Hello.
Hello, indeed. So many things to discuss. Barry, you saw no football.
I had an eventful weekend,
right?
And I haven't seen a great deal of football due to circumstances beyond my control.
Very much
which
so.
I can't really discuss.
Let me tell you that Arsenal are back on top of the Premier League, at least until Monday night when Man City play Chelsea. And as a result, we'll talk about those games a little bit later on. But let's start with the action at the bottom, because the entire bottom 10 are within a defeat of the drop. Whew. And also, let me tell you this, Barry, your lot Sunderland went and beat Newcastle 3-0 again.
I'm well aware of that. I wasn't completely negligent over the weekend.
But, right.
Yeah, it was a splendid win. Sunderland have gone from being rock bottom of the table to now possibly vying for a Champions League place. They were excellent against Newcastle. Very composed, fluid performance, controlled the game, controlled the ball. Scored three fine goals, and that's their third win in a row over the tune.
Jacob, you saw the game?
Saw the it wasn't on TV.
Yeah, because it wasn't on TV.
Yeah. They put the
There are ways.
West Ham Swansea game on. But Newcastle, Sunderland look very good, and they've been pretty good for the last 2 or 3 months, really. Beaten some good sides away from home as well. Got to the Capital One Cup final. They were bottom when he took over with no wins. And you know, it's an achievement even better than Harry Redknapp when he took over at Spurs in 2008 to get
What happened then, etc.
But you know, when Poyet took over, there was a lot of people saying, oh, they've just gone and hired Di Canio again, but he's nothing like that at all. He's not a crazy, he's a bit mad, Poyet, but not in the same way. You know, he's very talkative and
tell you what, you don't have to be crazy to work there, helps.
I think he's an impressive manager. You look at what he did at Brighton. They were a good side. And as well, I quite like the signing of Liam Bridcutt.
Well, I was going to say, he's brought a little bit of the Seagulls with him, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's a tidy little player in midfield. It's probably going to be a good signing for them.
Could Newcastle do with a signing or two? Maybe there was a fascinating post-game press conference with... I felt a bit sorry for Alan Pardew, who's the front man
the
for
patsy,
this,
isn't he?
Yeah,
but they don't like him because he's part of the Cockney mafia, and seen as the front man really for Ashley's penny pinching.
And the incredibly silent Joe Kinnear, who post his judge me on my signings, has failed to. Has he made an appearance since?
He's still signed. What, he's brought Loic Remy in?
He hasn't. They haven't made a permanent signing in the last two windows.
That's it.
And De Jong this time.
Well, the Newcastle fans were very angry about that on Saturday, and they were singing like, "Where's your signings, Joe Kinnear?" But I'm not even sure was he at the game. I don't think he was.
He's probably not even aware that Kabay left the building, seeing as he doesn't seem to know who he is or
might try and get him
what
on loan.
His name is. But I mean, they were without Remy, weren't they? He was suspended. Papis Ciso was injured, Sholo and Sammy up front. But it was a lifeless kind of performance from Newcastle. Take nothing away from Sunderland, but Newcastle offered nothing.
They were strangely not fired up for the game at all, considering how important a game it is and how they come into it having lost two of them on the spin, two northeast derbies or Tyne-Wear derbies. And, it was just weird how I don't know, lacklustre their performance was.
But if we all have the impression, and it's quite a widespread feeling, that Newcastle are actually quite actively interested in not finishing any lower than, say, 12th, but not any higher than, say, 6th or 7th, and avoiding the Europa League, that might be a feeling that's permeated its way into the locker room as well. They see Johan Cabaye going out, nobody coming in permanently.
It's a dangerous game to play because you can sit there and try and stand still and tread water, as it were, but the danger there is that other teams are going to improve, and if you don't bother making any signings and keep doing that and selling your best players, eventually you're going to find yourself in a bit of trouble.
I think Cabaye was a reference point not only for the team but for the French players within the dressing room. Mm-hmm. To lose him, you might think they begin to question, you know, their being in Newcastle or something like that.
Surely you mean to lose him?
Precisely, yeah.
Toon says, interesting following the pod's comments on Holland that De Jong was looking every bit a striker from the Eredivisie, dawdling in front of goal, thinking he had hours to place his shots. Not the best start, but he'll no doubt adapt. All in all, a disappointing afternoon for them, but absolutely brilliant, as you say, for Sunderland, up to 14th. And
yeah, I mean, it's only a few weeks ago. I was certainly sitting here saying, oh, they're done, they're gone. They're having a hope of staying up. And now they're 14th.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And looking and on an upward curve and looking like they'll comfortably survive. So it is remarkable how quickly things can turn around.
Yeah.
And how wrong I was.
Big thing is that Adam Johnson has started playing for them as well the last couple of weeks. He was good again on the weekend, and, you know, recent hat-trick against Fulham. He's a really good player when he pulls his finger out.
And how about Burini?
Yeah, he's got three in six games. I mean, mm-hmm. he scored and assisted one. Yeah, I mean, he's really come good, as his players like who have been written off and kind of were persona non grata, like Bardsley as well.
Mm. And Liam Bridcut was excellent, a new signing from Brighton.
No, the one we were discussing.
Yes.
Yeah, good. Well, it's such an extraordinary bottom of the table because there's so many of these remarkable resurrection stories going on down there. We've seen Tony Pulis at Crystal Palace, because they lost this weekend. We'll talk more about that perhaps a little bit later on. Cardiff with a big win over Norwich, maybe not that extraordinary, but some very promising signs there. Wilfried Zaha, in particular, being compared to Cristiano Ronaldo by Ronaldo's former teammate Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
Maybe not at that level, but it's really strange that David Moyes has never even seen fit to give Wilfried Zaha a start in the league, because anyone who saw him play for, I know it's a different level, but anyone who saw him play for Palace knew that he's got amazing talent, such great skill and quick feet, and he set up, what did he do? He set up at least one goal on
Bellamy's goal
on the weekend. And now he's out on loan.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of those players who's a bit of a maverick, who can give a real spark to a team, which is something that obviously United are so devoid of, as we'll probably get to. But I mean, as an impact player to come on and do what he did, yeah, I can kind of it's probably good to be in a relegation dogfight, because you never, you know, gives that unpredictability. You know, can win matches out of nothing, sort of. Make his team win matches.
Yeah, turn again. And of course they've got the South Wales derby coming up next weekend against a Swansea side that's won one in 10 games. Their latest reverse coming at the hands, Jacobov?
West Ham.
Yes, West Ham.
Yeah.
Hey, Nolan and Carroll, they got the team back together, haven't they?
Yeah, you know, the old partnership.
Yeah.
Carroll heading it down for Nolan, and Nolan scoring.
Two goals.
Yeah, no, two assists for Carroll. That's his third assist now.
So two goals, the Nolan-Carroll partnership.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, Carroll, since he's come back, has got, he's not scored, he's missed two open goals, but he's actually set up three goals as well.
But, oh, he's going to miss.
Yeah,
he's going to miss matches again because he got a red card. What did he do this time, Jacob?
He didn't do any, well, you know, it was a ridiculous red card. How Webb fell for the cheating of Chico Flores. And Michael Laudrup didn't seem particularly bothered about trying to defend him.
What do you think, James? Was Chico Flores cheating?
He squealed, and centre-backs don't squeal, is what Allardyce said.
Oh, right, OK.
Yeah.
Graham Paul has come out and said that the red card was deserved. Now, I'm not a huge fan of Graham Paul's, but he's obviously a referee, or a former referee, and he said that even despite Chico Flores' obvious histrionics,
right,
the intent was there. So even if Carroll didn't make contact, it's still a red card.
Well, he did make some contact, and I think
he brushed the top of his head, or his stupid ponytail, and he fell down clutching his face, rolling around. Now, if he'd stayed up, there was no chance that Webb, who couldn't see it because there was a player in front of him, would have sent him off. And the argument as well is that Chico Flores is all over Carroll clambering all over him, and there's an argument that Carroll was simply regaining balance. You might move out your arm when that happens, and he wasn't even looking at
you. You might think, I'll just swing my arm around there because I think his head
wasn't really swinging. I mean, if you're sending someone off for violent conduct,
he was swinging his arm around.
I wouldn't say it was more of a flail than a swing.
Okay, a flail. You
know, it wasn't. He didn't do it particularly hard. If he caught him in the face, it wouldn't have hurt him. I mean, it just wouldn't have. I say that as someone who's broken my nose a few times.
Right.
It takes more than that to hurt somebody's face.
I think Andy Carroll might have thought he might have some happy results by swinging his arm in that direction, but I think it was a harsh red card. It doesn't matter what I think. It matters what the
panel think.
What the panel think.
It matters whether they want to overrule Howard Webb in a World Cup.
Do you think they will?
I don't think they will.
In which case, you'll lose him for matches against Aston Villa, Norwich and Southampton.
Interestingly, or not, as the case would be, the Mail's Charlie Sale revealed today that when Carroll left the field and went back to the dressing room, Sky Sports News presenter Charlie Webster was in his ice bath because she just completed a 250-mile charity run in which she took in for women's aid. She went to 40 different football grounds. And West Ham was the last stop, so she was given use of the facilities and was having an ice bath, and Andy Carroll ambled in, having just been sent off. So he sort of went, oh, sorry, I'll come back later.
That's quite the picture, isn't it?
Yeah.
In the meantime, you've still got your defence, which is...
Well, not still, they're back, basically.
Yeah, oh, okay.
Yeah, and Winston Reid came on.
Yes.
For the last 10 minutes. But, yeah, he was sent off with half an hour to go, and Swansea were still appalling. And I'd be a little bit worried. I think Swansea fans are a little bit worried with what's going on there at the moment, because I think they've lost a bit of their fizz at the moment.
Hasn't there been a suggestion that Michael Laudrup's going to possibly lose his job?
Hugh Jenkins has given Laudrup the vote of confidence. We all know that what it means.
But he played Jordi Amat, who's a centre-back, in a defensive midfield position simply to try and combat Carroll and Nolan on the weekend, which obviously didn't work. But not only did it not work in terms of that West Ham scored two goals via Carroll and Nolan, it also meant that Leon Britton was on the bench, and Swansea kind of compromised their own game simply to try and stop West Ham. And, you know, I don't really like it when managers sort of react to the other team as opposed to trusting themselves.
Right. Well, indeed. I like Allardyce's quote, though, on holding on with 10 men. It hasn't cost us anything via the actions of the brilliant 21st century defending of the players.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, Swansea were stupid, though, because they just kept on putting in cross after cross after the red card, and that's not the way to get past an Allardyce team. They really miss Michi, who knits it all together.
I think, bony aside, there are other signings in the summer that haven't worked out at all, have they?
And Pozuelo's been good in flashes, and Shelvey can score, but he's not. You know, it was all built on sort of Joe Allen and Leon Britton keeping the ball, and they're still able to keep it, but there's no real direction.
I am puzzled, actually, because their midfielder Key is on loan at Sunderland and has been absolutely outstanding since his arrival, and you just wonder why they couldn't find a place for him in the Swansea team.
I don't know, but apparently Michu may well be back for next weekend's games. It might be a bit rusty.
He's been out for a while.
Yeah.
Middle of December.
Okay, quick word on Fulham, who are now bottom of ye table after 3-0 defeat by Saints. Not all of their new signings took the field. Heitinger didn't, and Mitroglou didn't neither. Brett Hangeland was back, but didn't cover himself in glory against a Southampton side that was on fire. Lallana and Rodriguez and Lambert. Worrying times for Fulham.
Yeah, very, very worrying. But Southampton were brillant again, and in front of Roy Hodgson, there were three English goal scorers. And I would certainly be getting Adam Lallana on that plane. Pochettino today saying he's as good as any playmaker in the league. You know, putting him up there with Ozil and so on. It was a great goal. And Rodriguez's finish was brilliant as well.
The pass, I don't know whether that was completely intentional. The Lambert pass, but that was incredible. I much enjoyed it.
All right, well, they've got Sheffield United Fulham on Tuesday, I think, in their fourth round replay of the FA Cup.
There's a suggestion that in today's papers that Kerbishley might be going to get the job instead of Mühlenstein.
Really?
Already, yeah.
By Tuesday?
Well, no, not by Tuesday, but I don't know. It was just a rumour in today's paper that Alan Kerbishley might be taking.
Wow, that would be totally out of the blue and in no way expected. Right. That's enough of that part one thing, because we've got some big things to talk about in part two and three. But part two next, eh? Arsenal Watch. Hey, since our last pod, there was the end of the transfer window with some exciting transfer news for the Gunners. Dick Law beating off stiff competition to land... No, oh, I see. Sorry about that. To land the highly rated Swedish midfielder Kim Schallström. It should presume it. If it's Schallström instead of Kallström, surely it should be Shim Schallström, shouldn't it? If you're going to do that to K's, well, I do Swedish listeners, let us know. But anyway, Kim Schallström.
Could go and consult Football Features editor Marcus Christiansen, who's decidedly Swedish and would probably have an answer to that.
I bet he would, actually. But I'm not sure if he would have an answer as to why Arsenal signed this player who had, they knew when they signed him, a micro fracture in his back and hasn't played since November.
Yeah, it's a strange one. And Wenger said he was desperate and wouldn't have signed him if he'd had more time. But
is it his back, actually? Because Priest has been saying it's his fibula.
No, I believe it's a vertebrae.
Yeah, it's his back.
A microfracture of one of his vertebrae, which sounds incredibly serious. Horrible and serious. But he's going to be out for 6 weeks at least, which sort of leads to the question, why did they sign him?
Yeah. Bizarre transfer... policy that seems to be adopted. If you go by the rumours, there were suggestions that Arsenal had also gone in for Solomon Kalou and Miroslav Klose, and in both cases had applied for a loan when cash was surely the only thing that would have led either Lille or Lazio, both teams with their own problems, to let these key players go. But I don't know, those were just rumours. Big banana feet, though, with an important point. He says, read Dick Law. There's a politician here in Hong Kong called Fanny Law. I foresee a wonderful, happy partnership. Hootenannies, I think, is an Arsenal fan and a disgruntled one at that. He says Arsenal have 190 million plus, pointlessly losing money in the bank. They're going to concede the title on deadline day. People don't realise that buying players is an actual investment. See Chelsea's 10 million profit on De Bruyne. De Bruyne, rather. De Bruyne. De Bruyne, that's it. Nailed it. Anyway, it doesn't matter, though, because vindication for Wenger, because... they beat Palace, even with a crook Swedish import, and they've gone top of the league again, thanks to the Ox.
Yeah, quite encouraging, I guess, because for, I think, the third home league game in a row, they gave suggestions in the first half that they might slip up, and they didn't. They found a way to win, and again, they found a different way to win. It's Oxlade-Chamberlain. I think since... New Year's Day, the opening goal scorer in each of their games has been a different one.
Ooh.
And I think that goes to show the kind of, not necessarily a strength in depth at Arsenal, but they are finding whenever, say, one of their match winners fades in form or gets suspended or gets injured, someone else steps up. I think that's been the case throughout the season, where you've gone from Ozil when he first came in making an impact to Ramsey to Wilshere and now Cazorla, who's playing exceptional football.
Mm. They were facing a relegation threatened London side that was defending for their lives in the first half, but they still found a way to beat them at home and score some goals. Is there a lesson there for Jose Mourinho, perhaps?
perhaps, and again, I think it I guess. Both Chelsea and Arsenal, to an extent, although they have got Giroud, are proof that maybe you don't need a 30-goal goal scorer in your team to be a title contender. I think, yes, City have the firepower to perhaps blow both of them away, but they're still within touching distance. In fact, you know, Arsenal, I think, did very well to go 2 points clear and keep the pressure on City going into this game.
This game tonight.
There's probably no one in the Arsenal team who is going to score 20 or 30 goals this season, but there are... at the same time, people who you feel are going to score, there are goal scorers in the team, a good spread of them, which does mean that, you know, if one guy's not playing well, then it's something you can always rely on someone else. If you compare them maybe to Man United, so much reliance on Van Persie, but if he's out, then you wonder who else is, you know, who you're worrying about if you're facing them sometimes. So, that is encouraging.
All right, well, Monday night, Man City play Chelsea. A lot of people will hear this after the game's been played, which puts us in a bit of a predicament. But I guess it's an occasion for the special one to show us how special he really is, if he can be the first person to go to the Etihad and come away with points. He's prefaced the game, interestingly, by calling Man City out on the fact that they can spend loads more money than other clubs can, following criticising West Ham for defending. He's presumably going to be attacking other managers for being Portuguese soon. What did you make of his comments re financial fair play, James?
I thought there was some smart misdirection there on his behalf after, you know, David Conn's piece in The Guardian about Chelsea's perhaps third-party ownership and that sort of thing. I think that was a subject that was brought up in the
You think it was
conference.
Conn that goaded him into that, do you?
Perhaps. Maybe there's more mind games there than... Because Pellegrini doesn't seem to rise to any mind games, does he? I think even the attendances, his press conferences are quite low because journalists know they can't get anything.
Is he enigmatic or a bit dull? What do you think, Pellegrini?
I don't care if he's dull because his team's brilliant.
Ah, right.
So, you know, he can sit there and say what he wants, but his team scores five or six goals every other match. So.
Will they score five or six in the... Stick your neck on the line, Jacob.
No, I don't think anyone will ever score, you know, that many against Mourinho's Chelsea, but you'd have to make City strong favourites.
We've seen Jose do a number on similarly free-scoring teams before, notably Barcelona, of course.
Yeah, but Barca beat him 5-0, remember, his Real Madrid in that famous...
Oh, yeah, that's true.
But, could that happen again? I don't know. I think... I thought another one of Mourinho's quite interesting comments was picking up on what Sherwood had said about them being the best, City being the best team in the planet. And he said, probably for the Tottenham manager, the planet is England.
Yeah.
So, at the same time, simultaneously slighting Sherwood as a little Englander and putting down City as well.
He is a master, isn't he? Should we move on then from the show? Gary, do you want to throw anything in?
No, I just think I think it would be very unfair to suggest that Pellegrini is dull. I think he's a very wily man, and he's sort of got that hawk-eye stare. And yeah, I like the cut of his jib.
Excellent.
You know, on Saturday after the game, Michael Laudrup was asked about, you know, styles of play, and he said that, you know, after all this debate over the last week about 19th century football and whether Mourinho is going to be defensive, and he said basically, you know, West Ham won on the weekend, so their style was right. Maybe next time our style will be right. The win basically said the win is always right. So if Chelsea go there tonight and they put, you know, 10 men behind the ball and they nick a 0-0 or a 1-0, then Mourinho will have nothing to complain about. If they do that, they try and do that and they don't get away with it, then he'll come in for loads of criticism. It's always the result that informs it.
All right. Well, enjoy the game, listeners, or hope you enjoyed the game. We'll move on to the bit of action just below the title race, that top four throng, which Man United had high hopes of rejoining, but then they went to the Britannia. It was an absolutely crazy classic Britannia match with injuries and very, very high winds. You couldn't take corners because the ball would just roll away every time. And Man United losing, which is awful for them, of course.
Take the game in isolation. It's kind of, you could say, Moyes was saying it's an unlucky result because, you know, we conceded to a deflected free kick, which was a bit lucky, and then a great
wonder goal,
amazing
Charlie
goal by Charlie Adam. But it just kind of all ties in with every week. You know, you can't be unlucky every single week, can
right.
you?
And United shouldn't be relying on luck to win games. Yeah, that, I mean, we talked about Arsenal earlier, about the variety that they have in attack. Even in this game where they had Mata, Van Persie and Rooney all on the pitch at the same time, I mean, it's unrealistic to expect them to click immediately, but they didn't really even give any suggestions that there was going to be something great going on there.
They were also unfortunate with the injuries because
Johnny Evans
and Phil Jones both had to go off in what was a very physical game, surprisingly enough. But got to love Begovic for a start. And it's a bit of a mystery how he's still at Stoke because he's clearly one of the best goalkeepers in the Premier League, no?
Yeah.
Well, he's excellent. And I don't know why he's still there.
Right.
Maybe it's he's Canadian and lacking in ambition.
I think that,
I don't know.
I think the worrying thing about that performance was Moyes coming out afterwards and saying, "I don't know what we have to do to win," which he perhaps didn't mean it this way, but indicates to people
that he doesn't know what you have to do.
He doesn't know what the answer is.
Mm. He says, "Well, we got to the byline 8 or 9 times."
Yeah.
Yeah, well done.
Which not again, American football.
Which, again, is a lack of variety in attack. It's about getting to the byline, crossing the ball in, and that's all that United seem to have.
Well, they've collected another record anyway, because that's now the first time since 1984 that Stoke have beaten Man United.
Yeah, there's lots of teams like that getting records and rewriting the history books this season against United. And David Moyes, I mean, I have a certain amount of sympathy for him, but he does seem to not really know what to do.
All right. Well, Kolo Touré ensured that it wasn't too costly a defeat for them because Liverpool were held... Jacob, you're already tittering about this.
Yeah.
Was it your moment of the weekend?
I think his reaction was the moment of the weekend.
Poor bloke.
Just looking around, trying to make sense of it all. Yeah, it was an absurd piece of defending or non-defending, as it were.
Right. I mean, you would never pass back in any discipline, but I mean, particularly in football, well, you never pass back in front of the goal.
Well, you do if there's no one standing right there in front of you who can then just knock it straight in.
Right. Steven Gerrard's reaction was quite fun as well.
Yeah.
Mignolet's reaction was fun as well. But yeah, the look of desperation on Kolo Touré's face.
I mean, that happens with... When did that happen? With nearly 25 minutes still to go?
Mm.
And Liverpool still couldn't conjure a winning goal. You know, it was quite an uninspired performance, I think, from them. There were a couple of times when Suarez and Sturridge combined quite well. But again, I think we talked about... I think it was a very good save by Mignolet in that game, but also by Foster on Suarez, where he kind of dinked it up and then volleyed it, and Foster made what proved a decisive save on that.
Yeah, that was 1-0, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Shortly after they equalised. But they didn't play well at all.
No.
Liverpool looked a bit knackered after the Merseyside derby.
Right.
Even when they took the lead in the first half, it sort of came out of the blue. Great inventive cross by Suarez to Sturridge. But yeah, there was always that feeling as they kept on giving the ball away that West Brom were just going to find an equaliser.
Of course, they didn't pick up anybody in the transfer window, missing out on Konoplyanka.
But yeah, what happened there? Because Ian Ayre went over
to
personally do the deal and looked like it was definitely a runner.
And matched the release clause, but they didn't release the player. And I think...
Konoplyanka wanted to go to Liverpool.
Hmm.
And they matched the... I just don't understand why... He isn't a Liverpool player now.
It's a weird one. There were suggestions that there could be some sort of legal challenge by certain parties to actually force the move through. Seeing last night, but I think someone from one of the local journalists in Liverpool said that it wouldn't be for Liverpool to do it; it'd be for the player,
right,
to try and force that through.
Oh, that's a bit complicated. I'll move on then to Spurs, who similarly also didn't win. They couldn't take advantage of that draw for Liverpool because they got held at Hull, although Tim Sherwood calling that very much a point gained. Hull are quite strong at home, and now Shane Long's there, and he's looking good.
Yeah, both of them look good, Jelovic and Long. I mean, they combined for the goal. I think Jelovic hit the post, and they gave, I think, Hull perhaps... left that game feeling that they could have won. I think they had several more chances than Spurs did, nearly all coming through from that new strike partnership, which they have invested a lot of money in, you know, 11 million quid, I think, combined. But it did, even though they drew, I think it did show signs that it can perhaps keep them up. It gives them something certainly different than having Danny Graham.
They've not actually won since they beat Fulham 6-0 on the 28th, whatever it was.
Yeah,
and that's the first time they've scored since then, I think.
Mm-hmm. Very good point. Everton, meantime, beat Villa, and a wonderful Morales free kick to get the 3 points there, Jacob.
Well, yeah, it's good to have... That's the second free kick Morales has scored in the last couple of weeks, so it's good to have someone who can do it with the right foot and another guy who can do it with his left. That's quite a good weapon to have. But I thought it would be a difficult game for Everton, especially coming off the back of... losing the derby and all the injuries they were suffered and lost Lukaku as well, didn't they? And Traore wasn't fit to play. And Villa are a good side away from home. They sort of they get underestimated sometimes. You look at it and go, oh, we should beat Aston Villa because, you know, it's only Aston Villa. But gone to Arsenal 1, gave Chelsea a scare, drew at Liverpool. They were 1-0 up and for a long time. And Everton sort of have that spirit and... managed to get the points. They're still only 2 points behind Liverpool in fourth place. So, you know, it was all doom and gloom last week, and suddenly optimism's back.
Mm, indeed so. Unless it means they go into the Europa League. Of course, here's a nice post from Dave regarding the race for Europe. He says, if Premier League clubs would rather not play in the Europa League, then maybe the European competition qualification should be amended to reflect this. So first to fourth would get Champions League. Fifth would be spared the burden of European football. Sixth to 17th would be in the Europa League. And then obviously 18th to 20th would be relegated. So basically there'd be a race for fifth to avoid Europa League. This could be continued into the Europa League itself, says Dave, with the league leaders' knockout tie winners at each stage allowed to exit the competition and the other teams forced to continue. There's one for UEFA, eh? Remember Freddie Adu?
Yep. Yeah.
All right. Here's Dublin Roo saying, he's turned up for a trial at Blackpool. Adds Dublin Roo. It makes sense because I do like to be beside the seaside. That's brilliant. He is there. The midfielder.
What age is he now? Is he
he's 24. Right. Wow. He was the youngest athlete ever to sign a professional contract in the United States, selected by DC United in the 2004 MLS Super Draft.
Was he 14 or something?
He was 14, yeah. Yeah. Now, James, how about that Leeds chat? Make sense of it all for us.
I think it's fairly nonsensical, isn't it? Yeah, fairly dispiriting for the club to have gone from, you know, let's say they haven't had good luck with owners in the last, more than a decade, haven't they? I mean, they were living the dream under Peter Ridsdale, and now they're probably living
a nightmare.
And then
they woke up. Yeah. Right. Then Ken Bates, and now was it GSH or something? What was that, the middle lot called?
Gold Cap.
An Islamic GFH. Investment bank.
Oh, okay.
And now who have now apparently are in the process of selling 75% of the club to the owner of Cagliari, Massimo Cellini.
Cagliari. Yep.
Massimo Cellini, who...
Cellino.
Sorry.
Anyway, well, here's David Conn. Very interesting comments on this. David Conn says, covered some car crash takeovers down the years. Goldberg at Palace, Romanov at Hearts, Venkis at Rovers. Cellino at Leeds is in with a bullet. David Crane says, 36 managers in 20 years. Are there any negatives you can tell Leeds about Cellino?
James Rieck has been covering this story for us, and I asked him this morning, who is Brian McDermott, the manager of Leeds?
He was
and he doesn't know.
But he turned up for training today,
right?
Didn't he?
Well, he was sacked on Friday by a solicitor working for Cellino, but apparently the solicitor didn't have the authority to sack him because the takeover hadn't gone through.
Cellino denies that he tried to sack him. He says, no, he's been trying to contact him to bring him back. How could I sack the manager when I don't even own the club yet, says Massimo Cellino. If anyone could, it would be him, of course.
And McDermott was going to go to the game on Saturday and be in the dugout, but apparently his legal representatives advised against it.
Ah, okay, so his second in command.
His second in command took over for the day.
What was the business with Gianluca Festa?
Well, this was one of the issues. Was I think it was a week ago, Leeds played Ipswich, it drew 1-1, and Cellino had asked that Festa be allowed to be on the bench, which obviously for any manager is a big sort of, it was undermining. Festa was there on for the Huddersfield game, and he had been shown around the training ground as well. Yeah, I mean, he's seen as one of Cellino's sort of right hand man. He hasn't caretakered it at Cagliari before, but he's been one of those called a co-caretakers because Cellino goes through so many managers. I know we've gone on to the McDermott sacking, unsacking, what's his position, but I mean, it wasn't at all a surprise that the first act Cellino wanted to make, even before the takeover has been completed, because it hasn't been completed yet, was to sack a manager. It's worrying because, he's one of the more controversial characters in Italian football. Yeah, he's the kind of guy who makes decisions based on the coloured boots that players wear. If it's purple, then you're not allowed to wear it. You have coloured suit.
Well, the Italians, the colour purple is regarded as unlucky in Italy. And apparently they had to change the press passes at Leeds because of this.
He doesn't like the number 17 either.
Also unlucky in Italy.
Yeah, so, it's quite irrational decision-making from my point of view.
Okay. Well, you're a Leeds fan, James.
I am, yes.
So you must have been delighted when, amidst all this, the team came together and won 5-1 against Huddersfield. Dan Mason tweeting, Leeds 5-1 up. They should sack their manager every week. Actually, they might well do that.
Yeah, and I think, Ross McCormack, the captain, really rallied. I mean, a lot was made of his deadline day sort of antics, which was, there was a lot of speculation about his future. He'd been linked with Cardiff and Leeds had rejected the bid, and he'd put out a statement to say that, he was staying unequivocally. And then no sooner does he do that, then the news began to filter through that, a lawyer had acting on behalf of Cellino had moved to sack McDermott, which he didn't have the authority to do. And again, that because the deadline day was so dead, in terms of things. That became a kind of Sky's lead story. What is Ross McCormack going to do in these last 3 hours? Is he going to leave? And it was just another kind of absurd day in the sort of history of Leeds United.
Right.
But apparently Luke Varney was supposed to be sold to Blackburn, and McDermott had agreed to sell him to Blackburn, and Cellino nixed the deal. And,
oh, really? Because he's still not legally in control of the club.
And he's said that he doesn't want a manager at the club, he wants a coach. I mean, there's some good people to follow. I mean, David Kahn and James, obviously, will be all over it. And then there's on Twitter, Sporting Intelligence, The Square Ball is a Leeds fanzine, and they have a podcast. They're a good gang of lads and very passionate about the club. And journalist Andrew Haig. So they'll all be worth following in the next few days on Twitter, because they'll get to the bottom of what's going on.
Just on the subject of Cellino, and he still presumably has to pass the arduous exam that is the fit and proper persons test. He has two convictions for fraud. He was in jail, I remember, over the Santa Lea Stadium, the Is Arenas, his replacement stadium last year that he was running for Cagliari. How would you explain him and his kind of somewhat questionable past to other Leeds fans, James?
Not encouraging in the slightest. I think
the two convictions were for fraud, but not related to football. But don't know how that helps.
But I think, again, the fit and proper persons test will be relieved to be a fig leaf if he does pass. But he can, to be fair to him, he can point and say, look at the other owners you've let in. You know, why can't I or that own a football club in this country? You know, I mean, it's not worth the paper it's written on this.
Has anyone ever failed this?
No, that's the thing.
I think one person has failed. I can't remember who, but I'm pretty sure one person has failed. Which takes some doing.
Yeah. All right. Well, interesting times in the Chinese curse sense of the expression for Leeds. We'll no doubt be catching up with more on that soon. But in the meantime, in a second or two, we'll dial up Sid. But having just got his answering machine, let's now hear a little bit about the rest of Europe. France, Monaco only drew 2-2 against Lorient, which means they are 5 points behind PSG. But boom, they are hosting PSG next weekend, and they'll have Dimitar Berbatov. How exciting is that?
I think it couldn't be a better move for him. Is it someone who you could just see him lazing, you know, smoking out the side of a boat, off the back of a boat, rolling dice, Casino Royale, you know, just going down a Ferrari on the Riviera. You know, I just think that's Berber, isn't it?
It's brilliant. All right, super stuff. Germany, Bayern Munich, still 13 points clear. They destroyed Eintracht Frankfurt 5-0 on Sunday. And Dortmund got their first win of the year with Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang getting 2 against Eintracht Braunschweig. In Russia, Zenit have signed Venezuelan Jose Salomon Rondon from Rubin Kazan. It must be a pretty brave fellow, because he's the first black player to join Zenit since the fans there issued that edict calling for non-white players to be excluded from the team. This was just over a year ago, because they said black players were being forced down Zenit's throat. What a World Cup we're going to have there, eh?
We have to get through the Winter Olympics first.
That's true. When's it begin, Barry?
Friday, I'm told.
All right. We think. Anyway.
The opening ceremony's on Friday.
Is it?
I think, yeah.
Well, I know most. I think the British team departed yesterday for Sochi.
Right.
Are you doing any Winter Olympic kind of challenges?
Oh, with Barry, did his lycra'd up biathlon special.
I did biathlon, and I did. Last week I went to Bath University and went down their skeleton track.
Ooh, really?
Yeah.
How was that?
It was fun.
When is the video up?
No.
When's it going to go up?
I think it's going up this week sometime. It's not as dangerous as it sounds. It's actually pretty idiot-proof.
Right.
But it's good fun, yeah.
And so it's not a complete skeleton track?
No, it's basically so the athletes can practice their starts.
Ah, right.
And there's this guy, Danny, there, who's the only qualified skeleton start coach in the world.
Really? And they got him?
Yes.
Oh, do we have a good skeleton team?
We have...
good work. Great Britain's
I'm
not
Irish.
Absolutely.
No, the reigning skeleton champion is Britain, Amy Williams, but she's had to retire from injury because I think her back is destroyed from hurtling down ice chutes for a living.
At what sort of speed, Barry?
I think they get up to about 75 miles an hour.
Wow. Why is it called skeleton?
Because the T-tray type thing that they go down, the frame of that looks a bit like a skeleton.
Oh, okay.
Apparently.
How does it differ from the luge?
That I couldn't tell you.
That's enough skeleton news for now. What were we talking about?
Italy.
Oh, yeah, Italy. Juve destroyed Inter, and it's almost a non-story because everyone knew this was going to happen. Big game, though, it was, Derby of Italy.
Yeah, because there's a huge gap between the two teams going into this game. There's 23 points. And although Inter have signed Hernanez, crybaby Hernanez, he
blubbed, Barry, when he left Formello, the training ground, for the last time. There's these great pictures of him in the car, kind of Harry style, through the car window, and he's there just in tears with the fans, and they hug him and they embrace him. He gives them his boots and stuff.
And he got.
I love the pictures, though. We showed this on Sunday. I love the pictures of the fans marching on Lotito's headquarters, which is in this medieval castle. So there's all these nighttime shots of this floodlit castle with all these villagers there, pitchforks and stuff. But they didn't stop the sale going through.
The fans had got hold of Hernandez's phone number, and they'd sent him thousands of messages begging him to stay. And then when it became apparent that he was leaving, they said good luck. And he had 10,000 messages. So he was so proud of it. He's put his phone on his mantelpiece with all his trophies. It's a little trophy for himself.
But as you point out, when the battery goes dead, what's going to happen then?
Exactly. It's going to be after permanently on charge, isn't it?
That story, in stark contrast, I suppose it reminds me of the Wes Hoolihan story, because he probably won't be as loved by Norwich fans after describing their club in most derogatory terms in conversation with a Sky News reporter.
Mm. Yeah.
And he was expecting a move to Villa and didn't get one, so now he's stuck there.
Stuck there. There you go. Be careful what you say. All right, well, let's finish off today's pod by dialing up Sid Lowe in Spain, because there's quite a bit to talk to him about.
Hello, Jimbo.
Nice to speak to you. You may not have long, yes?
I may not. I'm in a bit of a hurry, but let's try and get through as much as we possibly can in the time we've
got. You might have to talk to somebody. It's not that you don't have time for us, but you might have a thing. We can't say anything more than that. Yeah, you might have a thing. All right. Well, I understand, because that's very much your world, isn't it? Things and stuff. Let's talk first of all.
Things are my world.
Yeah. Let's talk first of all, Sid, about. And we might have to go, to be honest, as well, because we've got lunch. So we'll see how... Luis Aragonés passed away this weekend, and all of Spanish football stopped and paid their respects.
Yeah, and in particular, of course, Atletico Madrid, the club that he was most associated with. And in that sense, there was something, I don't know if wonderful or something cruel about it, that Atletico Madrid finally went top for the first time in 18 years and the weekend that he passed away. And it was really seen and presented very much as a homage to him, and the way that they're playing is kind of the way that he always expressed about character and spirit and so on. But of course, he's really famous and really revered in Spain for turning at last to what's become known as tiki-taka, and to deciding that Spain's future was best served by effectively handing power to the little guys and saying, right, let's play a technical game. Because Luis Aragonés as a coach had actually been defined more often by a counter-attacking style. But in the build-up to 2008, he decided, right, Xavi Hernandez is the man that's going to lead us. These are the kind of players we want. We've got to play that way. And as he said to Xavi in a discussion before that European Championships, he said, look, you lot are not the fastest, so let's stop trying to be the fastest. The ball moves quicker than anyone, and you lot can move the ball quicker than anyone, so let's do it that way instead.
Brilliant. How would you sum up his stature within Spanish coaching?
Well, it's a curious one, Luis Aragonés, and you know, even, I say this myself as someone who on occasions has been baffled by him, on occasions has wondered if his record was really as good as it was sometimes made out to be. Obviously, some of his behaviour was bizarre at times. But I think what there was with Luis Aragonés was a complete lack of cynicism. A genuine sense, I think, that coaching was about teaching, about really kind of working with players one-on-one. In particular, if you ever listen to Fernando Torres talk about him, the respect is enormous. And there's great footage of Luis Aragonés, you know, by this stage, already probably in his 70s, I not quite in his 70s, mid-60s, on the training ground with Torres, doing routines with Torres where he would be the defender. Torres would receive the ball, and Aragonés is going through him and kicking into the floor and screaming at him and shouting. It's very, very unorthodox, but very, very kind of, very hands-on, very, kind of very... deliberately, it's all about teaching, and there's something very genuine like that. And I pray, perhaps in a way, that's summed up in a phrase that he once said when they were talking about, you know, managers and the way they look and the way they speak and the way they dress and all the rest of it. And he said the manager should never be on the touchline in anything other than a tracksuit, because that's what a manager's job really is.
Well, of course, he said many things Aragonés, but we won't...
Was it him who came up with the best bottle-related quote of all time?
Yeah, so this is a Coppa del Rey final, 1992. There's a Coke bottle on the table, and he picks it up, and he says, if we don't win, I'm going to stick this Coke bottle up my arse. And he says to them, we've had enough of Real just sticking it up us. Go out there and stick it up them. And he says, and you see this tactics board, and he points to the tactics board, and he slaps it. He says, that's irrelevant. Tactics don't matter. What matters is you lot. Get out there and stick it to them. We've had enough of them sticking it to us for years. And then the one that...
Did they win, Sid?
Yes, they did. They won 2-1 or 2-0, I can't remember now. Futre and Bernd Schuster, I think, got the goals. And then before the 2008 European Championship final, Fernando Torres always tells a story of during the team talk, Luis Aragonés is talking constantly about this guy called Wallace. And I was like, Wallace? And one of the players kind of eventually plucks up the courage and says, boss, he's called Ballack. And Aragonés says, I'll call him whatever I want. And so the players think, oh, fair enough. So they're in the tunnel before the game. Now, obviously, as you can imagine, this is the European Championship final. Spain players are a little bit nervous. And the way that a couple of Spain players have kind of, if you like, embellished the story over time, you know, they look across and these Germans look absolutely enormous. And they're worried about it. And they get in the tunnel and the players are there and they're lined up. And Aragonés walks down the tunnel and he winks at the Spain players. And he walks up to Ballack and says, good luck, Wallace.
Because Aragonés is famous for saying one or two other things.
Yes, exactly. No. Absolutely, and I think, you know, it's difficult to make a very clear judgment on something like that, which obviously is he was wrong and he expressed himself badly and all the rest of it. But it would be a pity if that was the way that he was judged.
Yeah, and he is the man who transformed Spain into this extraordinary side that we've enjoyed over the last, 8 years now? Six, 7 years?
Amazing, the most successful national team there's been, you know, in terms of consecutively. Obviously, Brazil have won more World Cups and so on.
Anyway, in amidst all that, you were mentioning Atletico Madrid going top. Well, the first time in 18 years, the first time we've had someone else than Barca and Real Madrid top of the Liga in 5 years, Sid.
I must confess, I don't know the exact stats on that.
Supposedly,
it's the first time Barcelona haven't been top for 59 weeks. It's the first time Atletico Madrid have been top since 1996, when, of course, they won the league and cup double. And it was more than just going top, because they had the chance to go top because Barcelona were beaten 3-2 in a really bizarre game against Valencia on Saturday.
Why bizarre?
Because Barcelona were brilliant for half an hour, and then it just kind of all crumbled. Defensively, they were appalling. Piatti, who's by far and away the smallest player in the league, and he scored a header, which obviously of itself doesn't necessarily mean very much, but it was a header where he was climbing above Alves. And Barcelona just kind of sort of fell apart and looked really, really ragged by the end. So that gave Atletico Madrid the chance to go top anyway. But what made it even bigger from their point of view was that then on Sunday night, Real Madrid only drew 1-1 in Bilbao against Athletic, who, by the way, Athletic Bilbao played really, really well. So Atletico Madrid are now 3 points clear.
Wow.
So not just top by a little, you know, smidgen of a margin, 3 points clear with Madrid and Barcelona level on points behind them.
That's crazy. And Cristiano Ronaldo, to complete this remarkable weekend, got himself a red card.
Yeah, which he thinks is unfair. I must admit, I've got some sympathy for him. In Spain, if you lift your hands to someone's face, there's a very, very good chance you're going to get sent off. Referees are very, very touchy on those kind of subjects. And I think in that sense, Ronaldo probably doesn't have a huge amount to moan about. But it was a bit of a set to involving him and Gerd Peggy and Iturraspe. And I wasn't convinced that Ronaldo did anything more than, very much more than Gerd Peggy did. Maybe he did a bit because he seemed to kind of slightly scratch at his face. But he certainly didn't do more than Iturraspe, who kind of leant into him and did one of those headbutts that's more a head push than a headbutt. Iturraspe and Gerd Peggy didn't get sent off. Ronaldo did. I think it's his 8th red card in his career, 4 at Madrid and 4 at Man United.
Really? Very, very interesting. All right, well, remarkable stuff. Have you got Copa del Rey coming up midweek?
Yeah, well, that's what makes it even more exciting, because Copa del Rey is Barcelona against Real Sociedad, who, of course, didn't have to beat Racing Santander because they went on strike, and Real Madrid against Atletico Madrid.
Right, and no Ronaldo? Will that suspension count
for
the Copa?
Well, no, we're waiting to see the length of the suspension for reasons that I never fully properly grasp. It depends on the length of suspension. If it goes over a certain length, in other words, if it's judged something like violent conduct rather than part of the game, then it would apply to all competitions. If right. not, it will only apply to La Liga.
And
I think the borderline might be three games.
Okay. Santander, meantime, who remarkably did go on strike last weekend in their quarter-final clash, they were back playing this weekend. Did they manage to get rid of the chairman, Harry?
This is the best thing about it. They did, because basically the council that owns a very small percentage of the shares decided to back a new board. Obviously, the majority shareholder, his shares have been inhabilitated by a judge. So during this board of directors meeting, they were able to kick them all out. They've got a new board made up of ex-players, made up of people the fans trust in. This weekend, they played a game in the Second Division B, 16,000 fans in the stadium, celebrating what feels like a new beginning. But, of course, there will still, I think, going beyond just this weekend, there will still be battles over ownership, and I think there will be a legal challenge to the inhabilitation of the shares and so on. So I think it still might get a little bit messy, but it's definitely the start of a process that could see Racing probably not get back to the First Division, at least not in the short term, but get back to being owned by the kind of people it should be owned by.
That was Sid Lowe in Spain, and that is the end of today's Football Weekly. We're back on Thursday. I'm sure football will contrive something that's worthy of a discussion. In the meantime, many thanks, Barry. Many thanks, Jacob Steinberg. Many thanks, James Horncastle. Many thanks, producer Ben. And many thanks, you listener. Bye for now.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.